Okay. Thank you. You're good.
Yes, good.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, with that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee of Transportation and Economic Development for March the 23rd, 2015. We are gathered together today for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 5040, the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I will turn to Ms. Nabuka to give us opening words of wisdom.
Oh, thank you, Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, and members of the committee. Welcome to ODOT Week. We will be hearing from the agency on their large and various budget all week. We're going to take things in a little bit of a different order, and we're going to hear from the Chief Financial Office first. They have a good high-level presentation that will kind of set the stage, and then we'll hear from Director Garrett after that.
Thank you. And to that end, I would invite Ms. Brickman to come up and walk us through your overview.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson,
Chair
Gomberg for the record, Tamara Brickman from the Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office. I'm here to just give a really brief, like 7 pages worth, overview of the governor's budget and kind of the process that was used to put it together and the thoughts that kind of accompanied the process. Oh, well, that was good. So, within the 10-year vision plan, and again, these are the primary portions, the primary areas where they were, the department was mapped, and the department was mapped to economy and jobs for several of their programs, and some of the programs were mapped to safety. So, for example, maintenance and motor carrier transportation division and a few others were mapped to safety because of the role that they play. But the emerging issues that we were looking at and putting together the governor's budget was the multimodal transportation, primarily known as Connect Oregon. This year will be Connect Oregon 6. And then also looking at some of the issues surrounding the aging infrastructure, especially IT infrastructure in the DMV. Within the 10-year plan, again, in the economy and jobs, the mission is that Oregon supports a diverse, dynamic, and sustainable economy for all. And the way that we believe that the department fits within this is that the state's highway system provides access to interstate, and international markets for traded sector goods within Oregon, and that the highway programs also create jobs for projects that are part of the state transportation improvement plan, so construction-related jobs. And then within this, the safety area, again, an issue that I should have mentioned, DMV is considered part of the safety area as well, is that various programs within the department ensure safety of people in their community by promoting driver safety, which is a big goal of DMV, protecting financial ownership and interest in vehicles, another DMV goal, and then facilitating the safety of the traveling public and providing a safe, reliable network of state highways. Just a quick overview of an expenditure history, starting with the 2011-13 actuals. You can see that the budget was significantly different in 2011-13 for the legislatively approved budget. I would say primarily that was due to inclusion of money for a project that did not go forward, which was the Columbia River Crossing project. And then the difference between the 2013 and 15 legislatively approved budget and this year's governor's budget is a 13% decrease in funding. And you can see the different funding types where ODOT does receive general fund, and I had to kind of put it underneath there. They receive relatively small amounts of general fund, and the most part, especially in 11-13, it's for senior and disabled transportation programs, the same as in, for the most part, in 13-15. And in 15-17, we've added some general fund for other purposes. Some of it's debt service for a sale that will occur for the state radio project this biennium. Some of it is for passenger rail, and some of it is also to pay back the state highway fund for debt service that they've been paying on behalf of the state police's portion of the state radio project. This is, I wanted to show you kind of how ODOT spends its money. And this is different than the regular categories that we have. But 50% of ODOT's money goes out the door in payments to contractors, to suppliers for road construction supplies and pavement and asphalt, et cetera, and then also to counties, cities, and other governmental units and non-governmental units. And a very small portion is for capital outlay, because the highway program is excluded from capital outlay expenditures in the way we budget. So the work done on highways is not considered a capital outlay. The budget is also 8% services and supplies that supports the workers, and state government service charges, attorney general charges, et cetera, for the department. Their employee costs are 23% of their budget, and their debt service is 17% of their budget.
Before you leave that slide, mm-hmm. one of the things that I'm going to ask the professional staff to do is to take a look at those state government service charges. In another sub, we've been looking at how rapidly those have escalated, and given how large ODOT is, I'm quite curious about how much those fees have increased. I'd go back probably three biennia, and I'm thinking specifically about the data center and other state service charges. I'd just like to see a trend.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, sorry I didn't bring those dollar amounts specifically with me, but that's very easy to tease out. The information's very easy to tease out.
That's fine.
I'd be glad to work with staff to get you those dollars.
Thank
numbers.
You. In some cases, those increases have been shockingly high. So I'm not specifically talking about ODOT, but in one agency that we did in another subcommittee, an 84% increase. So
okay.
Please continue. I apologize for interrupting.
And then a slide that I didn't put together that I've typically put together in the past is just kind of shows you the breakup of the ODOT programs, just so you can see where the largest amount of spending is. And just for reference, of their $3.5 billion budget, 57% of that is in highway programs. And the largest program within highway is the maintenance program, and that's 13% of that 57%. And then the next largest after a highway is their debt service at 17%, and then the rest of their programs remain fairly fairly small percentages of their overall budget. The governor's priorities and key investments in putting together this budget were, again, based on multimodal transportation issues. So there was a package funding Connect Oregon in the bond bill, Connect Oregon 6. We funded passenger rail between Eugene and Portland at $10 million, which was actually substantially lower than when it came in at agency request. We worked very hard to get that number down from the original request. The department worked very hard. I shouldn't give myself any credit there, because it was the department that did all the work. We have the Department of Motor Vehicles systems modernization project in here, and then some capital projects, because they do qualify, because they're actual buildings, to build maintenance stations at Meacham and on the South Coast. And then we are put $10 million in to begin repayment of the State Highway Fund for debt service on the state radio project.
Ms. Brickman, before you leave that slide,
yes.
I would very much, and I don't know whether to address this to you or to the LFO professional staff, but I would very much like to know what's the true number of the subsidy for each seat on the passenger rail between Eugene and Portland. I have heard that number jump all over the place, and I think it would be very helpful as we get into the conversation, because I think we'll end up focusing on a handful of important things, and certainly that passenger rail is one of them. But I'd like to know what the real subsidy number is.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I believe that, and I'm going to look to Mr. Garrett, I believe they have that information, and I would imagine they are probably going to provide you with that when they have their rail presentation.
Well, I'm just flagging it. I would anticipate that they would, but out there in agency land, Halgard is probably watching this, and I hope that he comes with that number and the assumptions that underlie it, because there has got to be something that bridges the gap between the hugely disparate numbers that I have heard. I mean, a $100 swing, and I would like to know what the real number is.
Okay. Well, I will make sure to work with the agency that you get that. Make sure you get that information.
Thank you.
And then on to the next slide, just some other investments that aren't significantly high, but that I wanted to make sure that you were aware of that are in the governor's budget, are the limitation that would provide the Department of Motor Vehicles with the ability to accept debit and credit cards, and basically it's the bank fee that would be charged for accepting those, and they need limitation in order to pay those fees, so that limitation is in the budget. And then there's a $1 placeholder in a capital construction policy option package to look for potential options at funding co-location of facilities around the state. And so if something were to occur in the interim, then we'd have a limitation established and they could just come to an e-board and ask for an increase in that. And then just real quickly, kind of a comparison of the governor's budget to the co-chair's framework. You can see the dollars that are in the governor's budget with respect to passenger rail, $10.4 million. $8 million, which is not optional, that's a general fund. That's the general fund that will be associated with the sale of bonds to complete the state radio project. And that sale is going to happen this spring. If it hasn't happened already, I'm not sure if we've made the sale. $10 million is for debt service that ODOT has previously paid on the project that relates to materials spent for the Oregon State Police. And then $9.2 million, which is in their base budget, for senior and people with disabilities transportation. And that was increased during the special session in 2013, and I believe some additional money was granted in 2014. And so what I was able to find in the co-chair's budget with specific level prices was that the co-chair's budget does provide a proposed $5 million for passenger rail, and they do identify as a priority repayment of the highway fund debt service for the state radio project, but have labeled it as an issue to be resolved, so no funding is specifically mentioned. And then the governor's budget provides $59 million in lottery bonds for Connect Oregon 6, and the co-chair's budget does recommend some sort of bond funding for Connect Oregon 6, but is silent to the amount because that's all to be discussed in negotiations on what can and cannot be bonded. I know that the lottery bond debt capacity is a lot lower than our general fund debt capacity. And with that, that is the end of my presentation. And if you have any questions or any desire for any information for me to come back with other than what you've already asked for, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Colleagues, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to play the freshman card here. This is just a technical thing. You asked for a limitation on your budget to be able to accept the credit cards. Do you mean you need to make that an unlimited fund, right? Or can you explain that to me?
Yes. Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, in some agencies' budget, the acceptance of debit and credit cards, I do understand, is a non-limited amount, but there's very small non-limited amounts in ODOT's budget. And so that's a conversation that we would have to have with legislative fiscal on setting up something that's non-limited. So we set up as limited because the only non-limited piece of ODOT's budget is funding around their transportation infrastructure bank for loans, revolving loans, to allow that to go out. So in general, even debt service that the department pays is limited. And if they would have, if let's say, for instance, debt service went up unexpectedly, they'd have to come before an emergency board to get the limitation to pay that. So it's just the way the agency's budget has been budgeted for years. And somebody had mentioned to me about the potential of making that non-limited, but that's a conversation, that's really kind of a policy conversation for the committee to have as to whether or not they want to limit that or not.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, anything else for Ms. Brickman? It appears to be none. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll invite Mr. Garrett, the director of ODOT, to come forward. And as he comes up, I know that Representative Gomberg joins me in expressing our appreciation for you making the effort to come to Mayor Shirley Kalkoven's memorial service yesterday in Tillamook. She was a transportation advocate at both the local and the state level, and you honored us by being there. And I can't pass over Mr. Honeyman, who was also there. But having a director of a state agency come was a significant honor for the whole community. We thank you.
Madam Chair, first, I was humbled, and it was my privilege. Shirley Kalkoven was a giant. I think it was spoken to, using the co-chair's terms here. She made my agency better. She made the transportation debate better. And she made me a better director. And I am going to miss her greatly. And again, it was my privilege. And it was, as I shared a little earlier today, what struck me, and it truly struck me, was when I think, Senator, when you asked, or maybe it was Commissioner Labhart, asked the various mayors, her colleagues, her peers to stand up, and the room almost rose with just the respect that woman had of her colleagues and anyone who conducted business with Shirley Calcoven. It's like a family member that is gone, and it still touches me. So it was my privilege, and I appreciate you're very generous. You're far too generous with your words, Senator.
We thank you for being there.
So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and it is my privilege to bring forth an opportunity to give you an agency overview. I will fly very quickly over a big, complex business known as the Oregon Department of Transportation. Now, that said, over the course of the week, my division administrators will be up here diving down into their portfolios to fillet open how we conduct business.
Mr. Garrett, just before you go ahead, how long do you anticipate that we're going to do transportation safety today and motor carrier? How long do you anticipate those two sections taking so that I can get us out of here on time?
Those two gentlemen probably can run through their portfolios in 15 minutes each. They're very crisp. I'm going to be the one that lags, so just boot me in the fanny if I do lag.
You may lag away until 4 o'clock.
Very good. So I am going to share with you who we are, what we do, and I want to provide a context in which we conduct our business here. You'll recall that the Department of Transportation was established back in 1969, but our roots date back to 1913. That's when we were birthed as the State Highway Department here. We were there to get Oregon out of the mud, literally, to move things forward here. We are an agency comprised of roughly 4,500 dedicated and passionate individuals, men and women, who deliver transportation services, programs, and projects. Our mission is multifaceted. It is to provide a safe and efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians, Now, again, it is multifaceted, but it validates the notion that transportation is not an end in itself. It's a means to many ends, and we see transportation policy integrating with environmental policy, with economic policy, with land use policy, community development, energy, public safety, so on and so forth. We are an agency made up of 7 divisions, and we animate or we achieve our mission through those 7 divisions. Let me first very quickly touch on these 7. I will lead with Central Services, led by Clyde Psyche. This is the administrative arm of the agency. Its functions are delivered through a financial services portfolio, audits, information technology, facilities, procurement, and it houses the director's office here. We move to the Driver and Motor Vehicle Services, DMV. Tom McClellan is the administrator there. These professionals oversee and regulate the actions and the activities related to drivers and vehicles, 2 significant components here. They are the face of government for all intents and purposes, because sometime during the life of an Oregonian, they're going to conduct business at DMV here. So that relationship is key in terms of not only the disposition they may carry about ODOT and DMV, but I would submit about the whole of state government. I am proud of the professionals at DMV because of the transactions they conduct in a very respectful and professional manner here. And it's not only the individuals they conduct business with. This reaches across the whole of the state of Oregon in terms of the interaction they have with the courts, with law enforcement, with businesses, and with local governments here. It's a far-reaching business enterprise. DMV, as Ms. Brickman indicated, has 2 policy option packages. The first is the service transformation effort here, about $30 million as we try to advance and move forward the business practice and the tools we use to deliver the services to all those partners I just identified. The second speaks to debit and credit card acceptance here, trying to move throughout our field offices the ability for Oregonians to conduct business the way they conduct business just about every other portfolio here. Let them use debit and credit cards here. We move to the biggest portfolio we have, the Highway Division. That's overseen by Paul Mather, who is the division administrator. There are 2 major programs in the highway portfolio. It really breaks itself out into the maintenance operation side and the construction side. These good folks maintain and preserve, design and modernize the 8,000 miles of highways and roads across this state. The state system carries nearly 60% of the traffic and more than 20 billion vehicle miles a year. They are also responsible for the 2,700 state bridges across the state, as well as the inspection protocols for all the bridges in the state of Oregon, the 7,700 we have here, both state, local government, when you add them up. Mr. Mather will share with you the condition of this multi-billion dollar asset, where we stand today, but more importantly, as we project out into the future, and given some uncertainty I'll speak about with regard to funding, we can see literally our assets start to decline right in front of our eyes here as we project out here. Two policy packages dealing with, again, as Ms. Brickman indicated, capital construction for maintenance facilities, one in Meacham and then one down on the southern coast at Coos Bay. We move to motor carrier. Mr. Delpani will be up here a little bit later. This is the business relationship we have with the trucking industry, the 20,000 plus companies and the 294,000 plus trucks registered to operate in the state of Oregon here. Motor carrier's efforts ensure that the industry complies with the Oregon laws we have, economic regulation, registration disciplines, safety, freight mobility, and then deal with truck size and weight protocols. We move to the fifth division, transportation development. This is run by Jerry Bohart. This division conducts the planning, research, financial coordination, as well as data collection and analysis for the agency. It is at this point in the agency that we see the coordination between the financial disciplines as we start to build our STIP document. I'll speak about that. That's the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. I'll actually hold it up right now because I have the prop ready for me right in front of me. This is, we capture all the projects, the flows of monies that go through the state of Oregon here. So there's that financial coordination. There's the planning coordination, not only for the ODOT projects, but also for the local government projects as well, where we work the transportation system plans across the state, so we have a healthy transportation system. As we move from planning, we move to project development. Again, this is where the hard science start to animate and embed the discipline within a project that eventually takes it to construction. So it really is the alignment, the integration of the project and the program development for the organization here. The division budget reflects the activities that will incorporate both the planning, the program development division, as well as the highway division, because we have interaction between those two portfolios here, and Ms. Bohart and Ms. Mather will speak to that integration here. Additionally, this is where the Connect Oregon program is housed, and you'll see in the budget numbers that constitutes about 49% of the division budget. There is one policy package, it was mentioned by Ms. Brickman, Connect Oregon 6, in all total with administrative costs, $59.4 million in policy package number 110. We move to the next portfolio, and it is the amalgam of the rail and public transit portfolios. I've combined them together under the leadership of Hal Gard. Rail advocates for the safe, reliable, rail transportation across the state of Oregon here. The rail portfolio oversees and coordinates rail safety through the inspection and regulation of activities of the Class 1 railroads. We have two, Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, 20-plus short lines that run across the state, as well as passenger rail that runs up the I-5 corridor from Eugene to Portland. Safety oversight. What I'm talking about is we put in an invasive way, to be very honest with you, our hands on the equipment, the locomotives, the rail cars. We look at tracks. We look at signals. We look at the at-grade crossings, both public and private. There are about 2,400 of each, so about 4,800 crossings total. They're split about evenly in terms of public and private crossings. So we're hands-on, boots on the ground, looking at that infrastructure here.
Mr. Garrett,
yes?
I'm going to flag for the professional staff again, and I hope Mr. Gard is listening. I would very much appreciate when we get to his section on rail, some kind of statistics or commentary on the work of his agency and how it interfaces with the high level of safety inspection that the Class 1s and the short lines are doing. I think in this whole conversation about rail safety, not enough emphasis has been put on the work that occurs in the field to assure the safe transit of all trains.
I think, Madam Chair, Mr. Gard will be happy to talk about the coordination and the working relationship we have with the railroads. Again, as I say, both the class ones, but also the short lines, which really dominate. They are the small business, so to speak, in the rail industry here in the state of Oregon. I'm sure he stands ready. I know he stands ready to engage that conversation willingly. Additionally, this portfolio oversees the safety plans and disciplines associated with the 77-plus miles of fixed guideway systems across the state. What I'm speaking to here are the light rail transit investments up in the Portland metropolitan area, the streetcar investments, as well as trolleys, both in Portland and in Astoria. There's a reach. We oversee the safety planning of that activity. Policy option package number 160, as was mentioned, it is the passenger rail investment, the $10.4 million ask of general funds to help cover the operating cost of the passenger rail train moving from, like I say, from Eugene to the Portland area, then eventually on to Seattle, then BC.
Mr. Gard, I'm also going to ask Mr. Gard to include in his presentation, if he would, a summary of the public subsidies that have gone into the streetcar.
I think, Madam Chair, that I think that's fine. Again, we were somewhat of a pass-through, if you recall, that came through our budget, but we had the responsibility to document the numbers and such, and we have that information, and Mr. Gard will provide it.
Thank you.
We'll move to transit, the second half of Mr. Gard's portfolio. This is where our folks provide the technical and financial support for the transit providers throughout the state of Oregon, roughly 200-plus providers across the state, made up of a patchwork quilt of entities that provide public transportation for our fellow citizens here. In addition to the financial support, making sure that those federal grants, because most of our money, we have very little state money that goes into transit here. You've heard about the request of $2 million coming for senior and disabled. But the majority of our money comes through the federal government. And this is the apparatus, our transit folks, that ensure that those providers are receiving the appropriate amounts of money to allow the transport of individuals across the state. So in addition to that effort, they also focus on technical opportunities, identifying service gaps. They help provide where there needs to be a prioritization. They bring a technical discipline to that conversation with the providers. We also partner with the private sector and like Greyhounds or other entities in terms of the inner city operations to provide travel options for Oregonians here. Again, technical assistance that we provide in helping the locals, because there's a capacity challenge across the state of Oregon. The transit professionals are there to help inform that. Madam Chair, it looks like you have a question.
I do have a question, and again, I hope Mr. Gard is listening. We have all different levels of transit in this state, all the way from very sophisticated systems like TriMet that carries a gazillion passengers down to rural Oregon that struggles. And my question is, does the transit division have to be invited in to provide technical assistance, or is this a complaint-driven system? Is Mr. Gard looking out over the horizon and particularly watching some of those little local transit divisions that struggle? And specifically, for example, in Columbia County, we had a connectivity problem between Clatsop and Columbia where there was a mile or so, I don't know exactly how big it was, but a gap. Mm-hmm. And either you have a transit program that would take people from Columbia County up to Astoria or not. And a gap is unacceptable. So what that's since been repaired, but what I'm trying to get at is transit proactive or are they reactive after a problem has been identified with the little transit agencies?
I think, Madam Chair, I think we're proactive. I think one of our charges is to identify those service gaps. And again, it's all about connectivity, getting people from point A to point B, not somewhere in between and dumping them off here. So I think we have a proactive lean. That hasn't always been the case, I think. Years past, you can look back, we were somewhat passive in our engagement and oversight, discipline from a technical as well as a financial financial aspect. I can assure you what Mr. Gard's going to bring forward is a notion of an agency that is leaning into this. They are there to help serve, leverage resource, working not only with local jurisdictions, but some of our sister states to see if we can provide better use of the resources that we have in providing the trips to those folks that don't have the wherewithal or the means to drive a car here. So I think you're going to hear a good story about, again, a proactive lean into just that type of conversation. We'll move to the last, the seventh division, and that's transportation safety. And again, Mr. Costales will follow me here. Troy Costales is a national leader, to be very honest. I think we're going to be blessed both by having Mr. Costales and Mr. Delpani in here because they are leaders across the nation in their respective disciplines here. Talking about robust partnerships, I don't think this is demonstrated at any higher level than in the safety portfolio here. Coordinates the activities with state agencies, local agencies, nonprofit groups, safety advocates, the private sector. In the disciplines, focusing on the four E's, Troy will speak about the four E's known as engineering, enforcement, education, emergency services here. They will touch upon the various activities that all these professionals bring, whether it's in the team driver education realm, work zone safety, motorcycle safety programs, comprehensive, another national leader here in the state of Oregon, impaired driving programs, seatbelt use here. And I'm going to steal some of Troy's thunder here because I have to take advantage of this. We are number one in the nation in seatbelt use here. That just doesn't happen. It's made to happen by these dedicated individuals here, saving lives, preventing fewer injuries here. Additionally, this division now houses the Office of Employee Safety. So we have safety counseling for the various disciplines across the ODOT family here. So I want to move to the policy board, the Oregon Transportation Commission. ODOT is governed by the OTC. It is a five-member commission, governor-appointed, volunteer, Senate-confirmed. Right now, Tammy Bainey out of Central Oregon. She's the Deschutes County Commissioner there. She holds the gavel as chair. Susan Morgan, another county commissioner from Douglas County, sits on the board, as Dave Lohman. He is an attorney for the city of Ashland, city attorney there. And then Alondo Simpson. He's a businessman from the Portland area. We have one seat that's vacant, and in my hope within the coming months we will fill that seat and we'll have a full roster to continue to lean into the transportation challenges that are before us here. The OTC does indeed oversee ODOT, but its primary duty is to develop and maintain a long-term state transportation policy for the state for a safe multimodal transportation system. This policy document is known as the Oregon Transportation Plan. It is built upon six principles or pillars. The first is to maintain the existing transportation system to maximize the value of the asset. Bottom line is take care of what you have first. That is the first pillar. The second is to optimize the system capacity through the use of technology. And again, Mr. Mather will share some thoughts on how we have become innovative in the use of technology, the ITS discipline here. We are to integrate land use, transportation, and economic development. I spoke about it. Transportation is not a means in to itself, but an end to very means. Here's the integration of those three disciplines. The fourth priority is to integrate transportation systems across jurisdictions, ownerships, and modes. Again, better alignment. We get into conversations about jurisdictional transfers. Who should own the facilities and what? Ensuring that our modes are talking, that we're not siloed in our approach here, but we are thinking of a transportation system as just that, a true system that connects. The fifth
Mr. Garrett,
principle,
I want you to go back to number three and just refresh my understanding of this. And if you, I didn't prepare you for this question, so if you don't have the answer at your fingertips, you can come back with it.
Okay.
The integration of economic development, land use, and transportation has given rise to questions about what's the true core competencies of ODOT. And what were the methodologies by which ODOT, particularly transportation development, sort of morphed into a land use agency?
I think the ability, Madam Chair, if you travel around the state of Oregon and you sit down with a local jurisdiction, I will tell you there are three issues that come to the forefront very quickly: transportation, the land use implications, and the economic opportunities. They just seem to rise together, and they touch upon each other. So I think with that as the reality, if indeed you want growth, to fulfill part of our mission here is to support economic opportunity and create livable communities in the state of Oregon, you can see that those three policy disciplines will rub together here. So I think it's a natural conversation that plays itself out every time I ride circuit across the state and meet with a mayor or a county commissioner. These three issues will bubble to the surface very quickly, so they touch on each other. So the question with regard to transportation and land use is, what influences what? Is it a economic opportunity or a community development situation that mandates the type of roadway, or is it the roadway that mandates the type of development? And then that's led by the land use conversation, how things are zoned here. So I would submit to you, they are attached at the hip in every conversation I have when I travel around the state, and there is an opportunity. You can't move away. It's a three-variable equation, and those three variables are constantly in there. There may be others that are dropped in during the course of a conversation. Water, clean water, sewers, another thing that always comes in there. But I will assure you, a given in the equation are those three variables of land use, economics, and the environment.
Dropping down into the weeds a little bit, one of the things that I think, and this really is in the weeds, is that connect point between transportation systems and economic development. I'm thinking about a particular improvement that's going to occur in a portion of my district that will functionally cut off access to a gas station, and trying to figure out which comes first, the chicken or the egg. You're going to build the project and then ask for the access accommodation. And I don't know why we can't do the access accommodation simultaneous to designing the project. And I have worked with your access manager, who I hold in very high regard. Mm-hmm. But we keep bouncing up against impediments that are created by statute or by rule to do the common sense sort of thing. And you and I spent I don't know how many hours sitting in meetings talking about access management. But that's something that at some point we might want to touch on a little bit.
I think, Madam Chair, there's a unique situation. There is access. We're not landlocking anybody here. But there's a parcel of land that we don't own, that there's a protocol, and before we can do anything, you got to make sure that the right-of-way is in the land is purchased. So there's a protocol. It's an awkward hop in our conversation down in the Tillamook
but
area.
But I'm not asking you to case manage this situation. I'm
sure.
Just asking to lift this up as a global issue of how do you do transportation projects in a way that facilitates future economic development? How do you do them in a way that doesn't stifle current economic development? And again, to applaud you for making what I think is a visionary hire in your access management program, who is a get-to-yes kind of guy instead of his predecessors, who, in my humble opinion, were get-to-no kind of guys.
I think, Madam Chair, the reality is, and you mentioned it, there was a buildup of rules and statutes and regulations, and it became scar tissue. I think over the course
of... That's a great way to put it.
I think over the last several years, we have cut through that scar tissue. And again, you bring folks who come to the table who try to find a balanced approach, taking all these variables and balance it to move things forward here. Very quickly to wrap up the sixth. The fifth is just, how do you create a sustainable flow of money to make sure you're infusing the appropriate levels of money into your transportation asset? And then finally, let's be strategic about capacity. With the monies that we do have, let's take care of what we have. But with some monies, you know, you're going to have to grow some things. Let's use that money to surgically strike across the state of Oregon. I will hold up another document, the state of the system here. It's referenced in the materials I turned in. This provides information and the progress toward how we are doing with regard to the six priorities I just articulated. This document explains how we're doing and meeting those and seeking to attain the outcomes as identified in that policy document known as the Oregon Transportation Plan. The OTC has also probably made one of the best decisions I've seen them made in the 17 years I've been at the department, the creation of area commissions on transportation. These area commissions on transportation, as I said earlier, speaking about Mayor Kalkoven, but they have improved and informed the transportation debate greatly. They have brought a discipline in terms of policy construct, in terms of program, and in terms of project prioritization. We currently have 12 acts across the whole of the state representing specific geographical regions. The ACT membership, if you look, we have some of the best and brightest minds in transportation sitting around there. They truly represent the breadth and depth of transportation interest here. And they assist the commission in the development and the prioritization of projects that make up this transportation and the statewide transportation improvement program, the STIP here, this document I held up a few moments ago here. The STIP is a four-year document. It is our capital construction plan. It identifies the state and the federal funding sources, the schedules for the road, the transit, the bike ped projects throughout the state of Oregon here. We normally update it every 2 years. It's adopted by my commission and approved by the Federal Highway Administration and Federal Transit Administration as required by federal law. So that was a snapshot of who we are. Let me very quickly say and share with you what we do. I'm going to make a general statement here. I submit that the transportation system contributes to virtually everything of value in our economy and in our lives. It connects businesses to markets. It connects people to family, to jobs, to education, to healthcare, to recreation. We are committed to that purpose at the Department of Transportation, and I'm happy to say and very proud to say that we have delivered the investments that you and your colleagues, the federal partners, have sent to the state in order for us to make these connections here. I look back at some of the investments, and I'm just very going to quickly look back at in the 2001 to 2003 timeframe when the OTIAs were bloomed. Again, I'm going to call out specifically OTIA 3, the $1.3 billion bridge program there. Over 270-plus bridges, critical freight route bridges, were repaired and replaced. And I'm happy to share with you that they were repaired and replaced on time and on budget as well. I jump ahead to 2009 to the Jobs and Transportation Act, $960 million targeted towards 51 specific projects. 29 of those projects are completed today. The other all JTA projects are underway and will be completed within the next four-year window. These highway, bridge, and investments not only have helped strengthen and preserve the transportation infrastructure, but it has enhanced the economic health of the state of Oregon. And these investments came at a time where we needed to put paychecks in people's hands, and that's exactly what we did. Transportation investment really was a vehicle for economic stimulus and job creation, and that's what those two investment strategies certainly did at the time, given the economic cycle we were in. I turn to the non-highway side, the Connect Oregon investments. This is the lottery-backed bonds to fund non-highway investments in the marine disciplines, rail, aviation, transit, and bike ped. Between 2005 and 2013, the legislature has funded five cycles of Connect Oregon, $382 million invested in the non-highway modes. I think the takeaway and what we should be very proud of is that investment has leveraged over $500 million of other funds coming in there, so creating nearly a $1 billion investment here, truly needed given kind of the episodic nature that we have on the non-highway side of investments here. As I said, we'll hear about policy option package 110 and the Connect Oregon 6 opportunities that we hope to bloom in the future here. So in addition to delivering the infrastructure, I would submit to you that your Department of Transportation has also delivered innovation. I go back to OTIA. It really was a critical point in the evolution of the agency in terms of innovation, in the terms of pinching down the delivery windows here. We bundled projects differently. We streamlined the project delivery discipline within the Department of Transportation, from public involvement disciplines to design right-of-way, construction methodologies to environmental permitting. Programmatic permitting really started to bloom here in Oregon, and it actually took off across the nation here. But it started here with the OTIA investment. These initiatives that began back in that 2003 timeframe are now the way we do business. We've just embedded them in the way we do business at the department. We see savings in terms of time and in terms of cost here. I will speak very quickly about two recent initiatives, streamlining initiatives, because I think it's important to articulate the disposition my agency comes at in terms of being innovative. We're not flat-footed here. Partnerships with regulatory agencies is a foreign concept to most Department of Transportation. So as I meet with my brethren and sisters across the nation, they can't understand why we come to the table and work with our regulatory partners here. But it has paid itself off in dividends. On the state level, we just culminated something with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife with regard to culverts. Back in 2001, this legislature passed a statute requiring that nearly all repairs to culverts must address FIS passage. Yep. It was almost the gold standard. If you're going to touch a culvert, you better bring it up to speed in terms of FIS passage, but you must do everything you can for it. That carried a significant price tag. A price tag that started seeing us start to fall back in terms of the number of culverts that we could touch on. We just couldn't afford to get to them. So we were compromising not only the highway infrastructure, but I would also say the fish habitat and watershed structure construct as well. We've recently come to a balanced solution with our ODF and W brothers and sisters that allows us to move forward on vital culvert repairs, but ensures transportation safety as well as watershed and fish passage safety here. So again, working together, you don't need to do the gold standard here. You just need to do the job that allows us to move forward.
How is that protocol memorialized, Mr. Director?
In an agreement. We have a four-corner document that says this is a pilot project right now, going to school on it, but we have a four-corner document that says this is the responsibility of the Department of Transportation. This is the responsibility of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we have documented that in a, I'm going to say it's an agreement. It may be a memorandum of understanding, but we have a document. Again, at the same year, we just inked a deal at the federal level with the specific to the endangered species consultation with NMFS and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife here. Programmatic allows us to bundle up similar actions under one permit as we deal with activities, whether it's bridges or pavements or intersections or travel sheds. We can bundle it as one permit as long as the activities are the same here. Again, that just didn't happen. That came because we build on relationships and relationships that honors a very simple way of doing business. You do what you say you're going to do. If we say this is the way we're going to conduct business on these like-type projects, we do that, and the feds are likely to say, fine, we'll just give you one permit, rather than having single permits for each and every process. Permits that are concurrent rather than sequential in the way we do business has helped us move things forward. Along with the state of Michigan, we continue to innovate in the area of three-dimensional design or modeling here. We are automating the construction practices as well as our equipment. We are moving into the digital age, electronic construction. In partnership with the construction industry, we are moving into the areas of allowing digital signatures, file sharing, data and version control issues, and document and archival disciplines that never existed before, and we're doing it electronically. The industry has been out in front of us for a long time. We are now catching up with their help and moving into the digital age right now. Mr. Delpani will speak about Greenlight. This is an effort that I think has been in place for the last 16 years, but again, something that was innovated and pioneered in the state of Oregon in terms of the high-speed truck weigh-in-motion system that verifies the truck size, its weight, the carrier registration, as well as safety records here. If all is in order, that truck continues to move down the highway without having to stop, pull into the weigh station, and lose time. Over the 16 years, I believe we've pre-cleared 19 million trucks. Let me tell you what that means in terms of the economic and the environmental benefits here. 1.6 million hours of travel time saved, $186 million in operating costs saved for the industry. The environmental benefits are significant, somewhere between 37 and 63% reduction in the various pollutants that are monitored, be they particulate matter, carbon monoxide, the hydrocarbons, carbon dioxide. See innovation with the road user charge, another innovative initiative pioneer here in the state of Oregon. You and your colleagues have charged my agency to create a road usage charge program, a mileage-based fee, to transition from the gas tax, which again has been a good workhorse for transportation funding, but it is a tired horse, and the purchasing power is not there for a variety of reasons. We see this user fee as a transition away from the gas tax to something a little more equitable here. And so we are moving in that direction, and this road user charge is to animate July of 2015. We are on a glide path to make that happen in terms of the accounting platforms and the private sector folks that we will conduct business with for that volunteer group of 5,000 that will play itself out. We also look beyond the borders of the state of Oregon. We have a Western States Consortium. 12 other states are looking at this. They've actually put skin in the game to go to school in the decade-long work effort that we have engaged in. And we are seeing popping up in the various legislative forums across the nation similar types of pilots that are taking place here. So the transition is taking place. Very similar to the conversation that happened in 1919, when the state of Oregon put the gas tax on the table and soon the nation followed. What we're seeing in 2015 when we put the first mileage-based fee, hopefully the nation soon follows here. We're seeing a lot of that. Policy. We are better integrating and aligning our policies, cross-cutting our documents here to make sure that we're looking at transportation as a system. And you'll see that notion embedded in the policy documents that Ms. Bohard will speak to, the policy option package, the bike pedestrian plan, the state rail plan, the highway plan, and the soon-to-be-released transit plan. Transit plan, I think the last update was in 1992 or 93, so you see it has a little dust on it. The world has changed. We're updating these policies, but again, we're looking at it in a panoramic or comprehensive vision of how the modes and the disciplines interact with each other here. We have challenges, we have opportunities, and again, it looks like in the world of transportation that it feels sometimes like we're overcome with opportunity. But we'll move in that direction in a forward-leaning manner here. Spoke about DMV as the face of government here. Again, we have a great opportunity to change the business practices and the tools. We spoke about the modernization of the computer system here. We're going to move forward on that front here. Intercity passenger rail. Oregon has sponsored passenger rail services between Eugene and Vancouver, B.C. since 1994. We face a deficit in the operating cost, that $10.4 million. And Ms. Brickman articulated that there was a disciplined effort of trying to identify as many revenue streams as possible to pitch down what was a $28 million deficit down to this 10.4 level to operate the two trains, the Cascade train sets here. So we are working all levels to make sure we can continue what has been the policy of the state of Oregon since 1994 to allow for intercity passenger rail travel up that I-5 corridor here. So again,
The other things that would be very helpful is a passenger profile.
Sure.
It seems to me we've been doing this experiment since 1994, and at least my anecdotal observation is what we're selling, folks aren't buying. And I don't know how long we continue to subsidize the train and at what cost before we cut our losses and say we're done.
Madam Chair, those are all fair questions, and we look forward to what I think will be a robust, not only fiscal conversation, but it's a policy conversation. We are at that intersection, and I think to your point, we do have the information on subsidies, and I will tell you, if you take the operating cost and you divide it by the amount of money we spend, and the amount of riders that we have, we have a subsidy of about $120 per ride here. And I think that's the very simple way of doing business. What it costs us to operate and the number of riders. That's just the basic math on it. And I think Mr. Gard can articulate that. I know there are other methodologies used to come up with different prices to speak to the issue of the swings that you have heard in terms of the cost. But I think when you use, when you put on the table, what are you paying and how many fannies are in the seat? So that's the calculus that we use. We also have that profile. And one of the things I will share with you that in the most recent survey we found, those folks that were riding the train, 49% of them did not have a car. That was the choice, the mode that they have to move up and down the byways. But we can continue to break that down and parse and cross-tab that out for you in our conversation.
But we're going to, at some point, take $5 million more dollars out of some part of ODOT to meet the co-chair's budget, unless the committee does something differently. And that could be spent on potholes or crumbling infrastructure someplace else. And I guess I'm just asking the policy question, how much longer are we going to pay people $120 a ride to ride on the train? And is there a time when that's going to turn around? We've been doing this since 1994, and I just, money's scarce, and I just don't know how long we can continue to subsidize something that is $120 a seat loser.
I think that's fair, Madam Chair. Again, it's a general fund we're asking for here. There may be other mechanisms that we find to invest this thing. I would also, you know, we could walk down a pathway to start talking about the subsidies we have for all modes, because no one gets off cheap here, whether it's the highway portfolio, what was once covered by user fees no longer. About half, to be very honest, is now complemented with other funds rather than the user fees here. And you can walk through each and every mode and have a very similar conversation about subsidy here. And I think that's what we need to explore, because we do have a difficult decision in front of us with regard to passenger rail. We understand that.
I'm going
to
ask you a procedural question. You're 2 minutes into Mr. Costales and Mr. Del Ponte's time. How much longer are you going to be, and which one of them would you like to sacrifice?
I'm going to jump here. We've spoken, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Hansel, before you can. Senator Hansel.
When you were back on the bridge and other replacements, I just have a specific question. Almost every bridge that needs to be replaced, local government's over 50 years old, therefore deemed historical, even though it could be a piece of junk. And that's the reason it needs to be replaced, is that it's outlived its usefulness. Are there options? I mean, you know, we got one in Umatilla County that it should be just torn down and recycled, but we've got to jump through these hoops, which raises the cost exponentially. Is there other options there that on bridge replacement particularly?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, I think there are options. I think age certainly can dictate whether something historic, but also functionality, safety. And those are conversations. And again, and Mr. Mather can certainly articulate the challenges that we face with the condition of our bridges, because most of our bridges were built in the 50s and 60s. So now just do the math. We're in 2015. They've exceeded their design life here. And that's the problem we have in terms of the condition rating. And the condition rating will continue to move down, because we have this huge swath of bridges that are moving that are beyond the design life here. Madam Chair, I'm going to wrap up. I'll let Troy speak to the safety challenges. Our goal is zero fatalities, but we lost 352 people last year. What are the disciplines that continue to move in a direction? Our efforts are laudable. Our trend numbers are moving in the right directions for not 1 year or 2 years, but for decades here. But we still lose people. Let Troy speak to that. We spoke about the funding uncertainty, whether it's at the federal level, where they have a $15 billion deficit. They have not aligned their expenditures with their revenues. So they either have to raise revenue to come into alignment or cut. If they cut, that's a $150 million hit to the state of Oregon. It's about a 30% cut here. So we have some challenges on the funding side, whether it's on the highway side or the non-highway side. And let me finish with this, Madam Chair. We have a geological clock that's been ticking for a while here. Talk about the Cascadia subduction zones, Wake, and being part of the Coastal Caucus, I know you're quite aware that Ground Zero is that coastal area here. We're woefully unprepared. Now, there are pathways to take this on. The economic trauma is massive, something like $384 billion of economic trauma to the state of Oregon. Not only immediately, but years in advance, we will still be suffering. A similar type of thing in terms of lifeline. The first wave of the shake, as well as the tsunami that follows, we're going to lose anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 Oregonians here. It's what we do to prevent the next wave of loss of life, another 5 to 10, if we can't get in there to triage. So an opportunity maybe to armor up the transportation corridors that line this state, that line the valley to the coast. it would help blunt the economic and the life and limb trauma that will come to the state of Oregon. That's another discussion in another forum about how you invest and take care of the existing infrastructure we have, but in doing so, armoring up against a natural disaster that I say the clock is ticking. It's not a matter of when, but if. Madam Chair, we stand ready to inform you over the next 4 or 5 days on all the policy practices and protocols this department engages. And with that, I'll stand down and would ask that Mr. Costales come up.
Thank you. We're going to do Senator Monroe, then Representative Witt.
Yeah, a couple of things, Matt. I happen to know that we live at the transportation hub of the whole Pacific Northwest, which means transportation is even more critical, perhaps, to our region than it is to some of our surrounding states. That said, the federal government hasn't increased the highway fund in any way for many years and appears to be deadlocked. And this legislative body, I'm being told, may be deadlocked in terms of getting a state transportation package out this session. Can you give us any wisdom? Are you working with the feds? Is there any likelihood of them passing a major transportation funding package?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, no. I think the reality is they're going to punt. And they're going to punt till maybe the end of the year. There are a couple scenarios here, but they'll maintain the level of funding that exists as it is right now. They won't take anything up. Maybe they get, as next year rolls around, maybe they move forward and start to address potential investment back into transportation. To your earlier point, the feds have not increased the federal gas tax since 1993. It's still at 18.4 cents per gallon here. So I see nothing at the federal level other than just a continuation and a deferral. A patch, so to speak, not addressing the core issues here. I guess I would end by saying my agency stands ready to come to the table anytime to have a transportation chat. So.
Representative,
do you have plans for fishing the I-5 bridge out of the Columbia when the big one comes?
It's going to go down.
It sure is.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt, you noted the high percentage of Oregonians that use seat belts.
Yes.
Not many of them are children on school buses. Federal transportation safety officials have been reevaluating what was formerly common wisdom that seat belts are not effective on school buses, particularly in light of a recent school bus accident. I think it was in Colorado, where it was determined that lives could have been saved had people been wearing seat belts. Is it time for Oregon to consider wearing seatbelts or providing seatbelts for school buses and children riding those buses?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, seatbelts save lives. If you're in a vehicle, you should have a restraint. And I think both Mr. Costales and Mr. Delpani can speak to those issues. And I think public safety, in terms of the folks moving people around, whether they're kids in school buses or whether they're folks on tour buses, this is a conversation that we need to have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll stay here and ask Troy.
Mr. Costales, please.
Travel in Europe, all the buses have seatbelts.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomber, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the administrator for the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon with you to talk about the safety programs, not only within the safety division, but also all the way across the Department of Transportation. As Director Garrett mentioned, and I appreciate his kind words, and he set the stage, that we do work on the four E's of transportation safety, and we are very honored to have a 5-member governor-appointed Oregon Traffic Safety Committee that is embodied in statute and help direct our overall efforts. And we also have 2 governor-appointed committees through executive order, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII and the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. Now, Oregon is blessed to have all 3 of these committees, and the 2 through executive order, we are rare across the country as far as having a governor-appointed committee related to those 2 particular subjects. The committees, in particular the governor's DUI committee, recently has been engaged in ballot measure 91. And what that measure does, the aspects from a policy point of view and a public safety point of view, and they're very stand ready to in order to assist in that particular effort. In the program area of impaired driving, Oregon has been in the mid-20s in relationship to the overall rank of where we were alcohol-related fatals as a percentage of the total. This past 5 years, we've made tremendous headway. Oregon has now lowered down to the seventh lowest alcohol fatality rate in the country based on the vehicle miles traveled within the jurisdiction or the states, which is a tremendous achievement given that we've been around the middle, the average of the country for so many years. We also have the motorcycle safety program, which is outreach to riders and clubs and other road users. And through the advisory committee within motorcycle safety, we've overseen the motorcycle safety subaccount and produced the number one rated training program called Team Oregon through the Oregon State University for our delivery of service. The state motorcycle safety administrators just this last year named Oregon as the state program for the country. And Oregon continues also to have one of the lowest fatality rates based on vehicle miles traveled as well. Although the last couple years, that trend has started to level off. And so we are looking at what efforts we need to put in place related to motorcycle safety. We oversee the motorcycle safety subaccount, and Madam Chair was talking about subsidies, through endorsement fees for a motorcyclist comes straight into the subaccount. That's used to lower the cost of the training program that individuals take now before they get their first endorsement. That's approximately $72 per rider that goes through that course is subsidized through the endorsement fee that motorcyclists pay. There is no general fund involved in this particular conversation, no federal funds involved. It is motorcyclists paying for service directly related to motorcycles. In the area of youth programs, the driver education program for teens was shifted to ODOT and to the safety division in 2001. And since that point in time, we have seen a reduction of teens behind the wheel when someone is killed or injured by 50%+. Driver education is not mandatory within the state of Oregon, yet we still have 10 to 12,000 families choosing to have their teen go through professional training through a state-certified program. We had a study done by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration 5 years ago, and this last year, the Traffic Injury Research Foundation issued a study that Oregon's program has shown to reduce crashes, severity of crashes, and the number of citations that are received by teen drivers when they go through the program as to compared when they are parent taught for their 100 hours before they get their license. In the driver education program, we have the Student Driver Training Fund, and that is a fee assessed on every driver license and renewal. That money comes direct into the account with the safety division, and that money is used to offset the cost to parents for having their teens go through the training program, on average $210 per pupil. Recent legislation that you provided us the ability also to supplement that for any low or no income families in order to increase potentially up to $75 more. And you also gave us the authority most recently to reach out to communities in the state that are underserved or not served at all. That allows the agency to be the broker to bring together the classroom provider as well as the provider for behind the wheel. And we've had three situations where we've been able to bring service to communities that did not have them before: Glendale, Oregon, Culver, Oregon, and Brookings, Oregon, where we were act as the broker in order to bring those services to teens that otherwise would have gone without the training. As Director Garrett mentioned, in the area of occupant protection, we are number one. We have the highest safety belt use rate in the entire country. We've been in the top three for the past 5 years, and this last year ranked number one. And my hope is that for this calendar year, we're able to stay in that number one position at 98% safety belt use rate across the state. As far as for the area of traffic records and speed, we've been assisting law enforcement agencies across the state with their ability to go with e-ticket and e-crash software and handheld devices. And not only is this related to the fact that they are more accurate and able to look up the information via that handheld unit, but it also improves officer safety. The most dangerous activity that a law enforcement officer takes is a traffic stop. And by having them off the road that much quicker, because the device is able to process that information quicker, it helps law enforcement safety as well, and helps reduce injuries and crashes across the state. Finally, as Director Garrett mentioned, the Office of Employee Safety was shifted to the Safety Division this past year. And as the Highway Safety Office is focused externally, the Employee Safety Office is focused internally. How are we being proactive in trying to avoid injury, and how do we assess risk and try to mitigate risk for those that are put in harm's way? We have within the department, and particularly within the highway maintenance portfolio, that is one of the most dangerous jobs within public service, by being at the side of the road with vehicles going 45, 55, 65 miles an hour, just inches away from where you're trying to do public good by the work that you're doing. So I'm very proud of the Employee Safety Office and those officers around the region that come in every day attempting to make sure that everybody within our workforce goes home safely at the end of that day. As far as acclamations towards our state, I'm happy to announce that we've been asked to host the 2016 National Driver Education Conference, and we've also been asked to host the 2016 National Motorcycle Safety Conference. And people are wanting to come here because they want to get a little bit of something that we have in relationship to learning what our programs have done in order to try and achieve those at home as well.
Mr. Costales, where will those events be held?
Madam Co-Chair, both events right now, they have looked at the Red Lion Jansen Beach facility in order to facilitate people coming in through the airport from the other states. Parking area, because they'll be doing in-vehicle and on-motorcycle exercises, and so there's a piece of the parking lot that's able to be used. In the area of performance measures, the Safety Division has six of the key ODOT performance measures. Including the first handful that are in the areas of which I describe as a key program focus. The first one at the very top of the list that's approved by the legislature is the overall fatality rate for the state of Oregon. For 50 years, Oregon was worse than the national average when it came to fatality based on the number of vehicle miles traveled in Oregon. Ever since 1999, we have been at or below that national average. Sometimes it's by as much as 30%. And that is an extremely remarkable thing to do in a rural and frontier-based state. Most of those states that have a better fatality rate than Oregon are smaller states that have a very big urban population in large cities. It's great to be able to sit here and share with you the story that for the last 15 years, including this last year, even with the small increase in fatalities across the state, we will still be at or below the national average going on to our 15th year. That would jump ahead to related to alcohol fatalities, and this is a measure that's also watched at the national level. And as I mentioned, Oregon's now the seventh lowest. Yes, it is alcohol only in relationship to what we track. However, within our highway safety plan every year, we're looking at other substances that impair as well, and the combination of other substances with alcohol. And all of those types of efforts are run through the Governor's Advisory Committee and DUII for our efforts using federal funds towards that effort. And as mentioned earlier, number one in the country for safety belts, yet our area of focus happens to be the booster seat age children in this state, where they've graduated from a child seat, but before they're ready for an adult seat without some sort of boost to make sure that the adult belt rides across the shoulder and across the abdomen correctly. So if something does happen, the belt is doing its job in trying to keep that young child safe. There is a page in the presentation that's a list of about 11 or 12 other measures. Not key performance measures as brought to the legislature, but those are measures under the MAP 21 federal transportation package that requires all highway safety offices in the country to measure those to see how well they're doing across a large set of different highway safety programs. And Oregon reports on these. We have very aggressive, visionary goals in relationship to where we're trying to head. And sometimes that gets us in trouble, because as we look for that vision of reaching zero and being aggressive, it turns up the heat on us to make sure that we're delivering projects and making sure that we're putting the money both reactive to where there's a problem, but looking proactive of where can we prevent a problem. And a lot of that work is done through 56 local traffic safety committees around the state that are eyes and ears within the communities and bring to us items, bring to us requests for equipment or for training that we can support that local traffic safety committee in their efforts within their community. The only major change within the safety division is that shift of the employee safety office from the director's office to the safety division. There are no policy packages beyond that particular technical shift. And with that, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Costales. Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Costales, is there any kind of relationship that you can speak to between the quality of the, I don't know how to phrase this, the quality of the upkeep on the roads and traffic safety?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Nierman, there are different studies that talk about road condition and how that impacts how people behave. That's called human factors engineering. And there are elements of what does the road tell you as the road user, whether you're a walker, a bicyclist, motorcyclist, car, or motor carrier driver. And the relationship between the environment and you determines how you behave on that particular roadway. If there is debris in the area and it is known, then people will drive with more caution with their heads up and their eyes open. If it is a free and clear roadway, well, then they behave that way because there is no obstacles in their way.
Thank you. Mr. Del Ponte. And colleagues, if Mr. Del Ponte takes 5 minutes extra, could I ask your indulgence to stay to finish his presentation? Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Del Ponte.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. I'm Greg Del Ponte. I'm the administrator of ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. I'll go very quickly. I'll try to get you out of here on time. But if I'm going to go fast, I'd like to begin with my ending comment. And that is, some folks have described me as being a visionary administrator. That's probably generous. But if it's true, it's entirely because I stand on the shoulders of giants. I want to begin by telling you that the men and women that work in the Motor Carrier Transportation Division are at the top of their craft. And because of that, in virtually all the program areas I'm going to discuss, Oregon enjoys a national reputation of being the best in the game, the best in the business. And that's because we have the best and the brightest, to borrow a line from Director Garrett. So with that in mind, we regulate commercial trucking in the state of Oregon. We work with motor carriers ranging from one truck, single truck owner operators, to carriers with large fleets numbering thousands of trucks and operating throughout the United States and Canada. This program deals with accounts for approximately 20,000 motor carriers operating roughly 295,000 trucks registered to operate in the state of Oregon. And that includes about 7,600 Oregon-based trucking companies. We operate our division with five sections, including, in order, investigation, safety, and federal programs, Salem Motor Carrier Services, Field Carrier Services, Motor Carrier Audit, and Economic Regulation and Complaint Resolution. And I'll say just a few words about each one of those to give you a flavor of what kind of work activities are transpiring through our division. I'll begin with safety and federal programs. Highway safety is a top priority for the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Staff perform vehicle and driver inspections. Last year in the state of Oregon, almost 53,000 individual truck and driver inspections were conducted throughout the state. Of those, over 36,000 were performed by ODOT staff. Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 810.560 directs that ODOT train and certify any law enforcement personnel in the state of Oregon that chooses to enforce federal motor carrier safety regulations. We train staff in a facility in our Woodburn Port of Entry. It's a classroom setting. We train and certify and direct the efforts of certified truck inspectors across the state. ODOT professional safety staff conduct compliance reviews at carrier terminals, think of that as a stem to stern review of all safety programs in place at a Oregon motor carrier terminal. Last year, Oregon staff performed 502 such compliance reviews. Staff in this section maintain the green light system that Director Garrett alluded to. It's an automated pre-clearance system that allows safe and legal trucks to bypass open way stations at highway speeds without diverting from the freeway. And we do that through the use of a device called a transponder. Looks like this. It's mounted in participating trucks. We have roughly 4,700 motor carriers that subscribe to and participate in Oregon's Green Light program, and a combined fleet of about 34,000 trucks that have a transponder in them. Next up, I'd like to say a few words about our Salem Motor Carrier Services section, this being the second of five program areas. You recognize the trucks that we plate. They have the red and white, or more recently, the black and white license plates on them. This staff issue or renews more than 43,000 truck license plates each year. They issue almost 250,000 temporary passes and trip permits each year. They ensure that motor carriers are paying their registration fees, filing their road use tax, and paying their taxes on time. They annually collect about $285 million in weight mile tax and another $40 million in Oregon truck registration fees. They ensure that all intrastate motor carriers have the prescribed amounts of liability insurance and, when necessary, cargo insurance. They help more than 4,900 Oregon-based interstate motor carriers discharge their registration and fuel tax obligations to the other states in which they operate through the International Registration Plan, known as the IRP, or the International Fuel Tax Agreement, known as IFTA, which are base state agreements. This staff collects and distributes more than $49 million in registration fees and in fuel taxes that are payable to other jurisdictions in which Oregon-based interstate motor carriers operate. And this staff also ensures that bond or cash deposits are filed and maintained to secure the tax and fee payments that are due the state of Oregon. Here I would just pause and tell you that not a week goes by that I don't get a phone call from a motor carrier in some part of the United States or in Canada that suggests to me that my staff host conferences and give lessons to other state DOTs and regulatory agencies on how to deal favorably with the regulated motor carrier industry. We operate a telephone bank, a telephone permit, 24-hour presence. We deal with motor carriers all over the United States, and I think it's worthwhile to note for you that motor carriers all across the country and throughout Canada, they constantly rank Oregon number one in terms of customer service and personality on the telephone. Motor Carrier Transportation Division was one of the first Oregon state agencies to take credit cards and, more importantly, to use that to leverage hosting an internet-based, web-based service site that allows motor carriers to go online to conduct business. So instead of standing in line at a customer service counter in a lobby or mailing things in, they can obtain a credential or pay a fee or submit a tax report from the convenience of a computer terminal in their home or office. Staff issues single trip and continuous operation permits for oversize, overweight, or unusually configured loads. We provide safe routing instructions and get loads where they need to go throughout the state. The staff also plays a critical role in working along with our highway division to maintain freight mobility during construction projects where we are advising motor carriers of limitations in structures, size limitations due to construction limitations, identifying alternate routes of travel and detours, and keeping freight moving, keeping the Oregon economy moving. The third program area I'd like to talk about is field carrier services. Motor carrier enforcement officers operate six ports of entry, 88 fixed way stations, and dozens of portable scale sites across the state of Oregon. They weigh and measure trucks, they write citations, they issue warnings, and they require non-conforming loads to legalize before they proceed. Their efforts work to preserve the infrastructure, to make certain that we realize the full intended design life of the infrastructure. And they also, through the performance of their duties, collect data points which enable the conduct of weight mile tax audits and safety hours of service audits. The fourth or fifth program areas I'll touch upon is our motor carrier audit program. This motor carrier division staff audits weight mile tax returns, audits the IRP and the IFTA program. As member of both Bay State agreements, Oregon is obligated to perform a prescribed level of audits on for the benefit of our sister jurisdictions, and we do so through that section. Last year, our auditors screened over 24,000 accounts to determine which accounts warranted closer scrutiny. And through their efforts, we completed 690 weight mile tax audits and assessed almost just under $6 million of unreported weight mile tax. The fifth area of the division is the Economic Regulation and Complaint Resolution Program. This particular division is responsible for the economic regulation of household goods and regular route passenger carriage. In the state of Oregon, these sections are subject to economic regulation, which includes oversight of entry into the business, rates assessed to the public, and the routes traveled or territories served. This particular section also has responsibility for processing civil monetary complaints under the Administrative Procedures Act for the division. In the last calendar year, staff completed over 1,000 civil complaint enforcement actions. I'll move quickly to talk a little bit about performance measures. And first one being, key performance measure regarding truck at fault accidents. Trucks were involved in 61 more accidents in calendar year 2013 as compared to 2012, but the severity of the crashes was substantially reduced from prior years as there were fewer deaths and fewer injuries. Moreover, since truck miles traveled increased in 2013 as opposed to 2012, the rate at which those accidents occurred actually decreased in 2013 as compared to 2012 per million miles traveled of trucks. Of 700 truck at fault crashes in 2013, only 24 or 4% of the total were attributed to a mechanical problem or deficiency of the truck. The overwhelming majority of truck at fault crashes results from driver deficiencies. In six separate multi-day continuous enforcement exercises conducted all over the state during the course of calendar year 2013, Oregon inspectors checked over 4,101 drivers and placed 23% of them out of service. Oregon inspectors distinguished themselves. There are federally reported statistics that compare and contrast the efficacy and the efficiency of inspectors domiciled in each state. And for the last several years, Oregon inspectors have ranked number one in the country as being the most efficient, well-trained, and effective inspectors. Beyond the safety performance measure, the other one I will just quickly highlight for you is our customer service measure. Customer service measurements are conducted every 2 years. Our survey responses continue to hold steady with between 87 to 90% of surveyed customers rating their overall motor carrier transportation division experience as being good or excellent. And you, when you couple that fact with the notion that we have over the years decreased our assigned FTE staffing levels because we have taken advantage of innovations in technology and changes in the manner in which we conduct business, I would offer to you that's remarkable. Major changes over the past 10 years, I already touched on it. We reduced FTE by 20 positions in the 2013-15 biennium. as a result of self-imposed right-sizing initiatives. And this is just the latest accomplishment in a series of such accomplishments over the years. With regard to containing costs and improving program delivery, I've mentioned now a couple of times that we're innovators. You've heard about Greenlight. You've heard about trucking online. I will just mention now our most recent undertaking is a program we have done in concert with an international company, E-Road. In essence, what we have done is we have created the mechanism by which a motor carrier can jump in the truck, go wherever they wish to go as often as they want to go, and at the end of the month, receive an invoice for their metered use of the highway system in a manner analogous to getting a phone bill at the end of the month for your use of the utility system. It's a remarkable program. It's been audited by Oregon's Secretary of State. The audit report's on their website. They hail it as a tremendous advancement in the manner in which truck taxes are collected. And I would venture to say that this will likely be a harbinger of what truck tax collections will look like nationally going ahead in time. I'm coming to the end of the presentation. I want to touch on major budget issues. And there are two that I would call out for your attention. Motor Carrier Transportation Division collects $285 million in weight mile taxes and $40 million in registration fees. Bank card fees or credit card fees have become a significant expenditure for the division. Our fees ran $450,000 in 2005. In 2013, they amounted $1.6 million. In 2014, they topped $2 million for the year. In 2007, we had a budget package number 301 that was approved for $750,000 a year in service and supplies expense. And we will, not this time, but in the not too distant future, probably come back to the legislature and ask to revisit that. That is an escalating cost for us.
Mr. Del Ponte, do you handle those, or are your the fee arrangements with whatever the bank is negotiated through the treasurer's office, through ODOT? How's that handled?
Madam Co-Chair, that is between the Treasury and the U.S. bank partner for the state of Oregon, and between the issuing banks that issued the credit cards. There's a complex fee sharing structure there. Some of it's negotiable, some of it is not.
Could you get us a little breakdown, get it to the professional staff, and they'll distribute it among the committee members? This is an issue that Co-Chair Gomberg has taken up to bring some degree of uniformity to the bank card charges and how those charges are handled by agencies as well as Treasury.
Madam Co-Chair, I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Last item on credit cards. We are aware of that's a significant driver, but it's necessary to have a settlement mechanism if you're going to have an internet web-based service offering. And so we began several years ago another program called Direct Payment. Direct Payment is an attempt to move a customer from a credit card to an ACH or automated clearinghouse transaction to settle a debt. In a credit card transaction, the bank fee is roughly 2% of the transaction amount. And you can see how that ratchets up very quickly if you're transacting $285 million in tax collections. By comparison, an ACH transaction costs a total of 6 cents, regardless of the transaction amount. Direct payment program is what we initiated, and receipts in that program totaling $67 million. Since January of 2009, when it debuted, represent a savings of almost $1.4 million in credit card fees that we've averted. Now, I'll be very blunt and tell you that the difficulty here is motor carriers can rack up considerable number of frequent flyer miles on a credit card, and there is no incentive or perk for using an ACH transaction, aside from the moral suasion that I might apply to ask them to consider that they would be funding an additional road improvement by not using a credit card. You're right, not a very effective argument. And the last issue, I think, of merit with regard to a major budget issue has to do with the fact that the Motor Carrier Transportation Division did not apply for the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program Fund for the coming biennium. That reflects a change over past many years of operation, but it reflects changes in the transaction on both the federal side and the state side. Early on, the Department of Transportation used these federal grant dollars to bring along law enforcement partners as contracted subcontractors to the department, assisting us in the performance of truck and driver safety inspections. At the zenith, we had as many as 22 compensated law enforcement partners participating. In 2003, the Legislative Assembly directed us to eliminate the bulk of those external partnerships and focus the entire dollar amount on the Oregon State Police. We did so. Oregon State Police endeavored to maintain that level of work activity required to consume that level of federal funding, but found in 2009 that it was no longer an efficient use of their manpower, their resources, or their time to continue to take advantage of the MCSAP grant, and they opted out of the program in 2009. In the years since, ODOT has attempted to re-stimulate some external law enforcement partnerships, but you can readily imagine that OSP had 300 trained investigators working, and we picked up two here, three here, five there, perhaps 10 there. It was difficult to reconstruct that book of business. In addition, on the federal side, the program has changed. It's currently a matter of much national discussion as FMCSA, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administrator, is defending itself and reinventing itself. Our observation was that continued participation was going to obligate us to perform prescribed duties that come along with the grant dollars. In other words, our hands were tied. And we use statistical regression analysis to ensure that we're investing our resources in safety actions and safety work that is directly correlated to reducing truck at fault accidents. I'm sorry to report that the federal requirements are not correlated in that fashion, and therefore we would be working against our goal of reducing truck at fault accidents to obligate ourselves to federal dollars that coerced or made our program choices for us. We are working diligently with our federal partners to amend those issues of disagreement. Director Garrett and I have met with Washington, D.C. officials, and I have every hope that I will be able to report in a future session that we have re-engaged the MCSAP grant, and that truly is our intent, but today it's just not good business. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions
you have. Thank you, colleagues. Any questions? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for channeling my concern about the credit card payments. When you provide that information to us, I'd appreciate a little bit of background on what an average account might run in a year. You made reference to frequent flyer benefits and other incentives, and I'd like to take a look at what kind of incentives there are. Anti-incentives there might be for using alternative programs. So if you could get that for us, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Be happy to do that.
Any other questions? Colleagues, thank you for your indulgence, unless there's anything for the good of the order. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to note that I received some communication a few minutes ago from the Speaker and President that we may be having full Ways and Means on Thursday.
That's right.
If that happens, I understand that that may cut into our time here, stopping us at about 4 o'clock. And that might be a consideration for our total strategy planning for covering our necessary topics.
Thank you very much. Okay, noted. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? We're adjourned.
I have to finish by about 1:00.